بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. All praises are Allah's, Lord of the worlds. And may his peace and blessings be upon our Master, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and his pure Immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. It's an honor to be in your presence once again. It's always an honor to be in LA, and especially at Yasin. And the blessing is on, it's for me to be in your company. Being the Fatimiyya period, with your permission, I decided to speak about the status of women in Islam. But it from an angle which isn't talked about too much. And that's the ethical and irfani angles of the woman, the status of the woman, how the Gnostics perceive and have perceived the woman according to verses of the Holy Quran and traditions from the Ahlul Bayt. Oh, hi, yes. You may have heard many traditions which I'll mention during the next few nights, but the interpretations are very important. Sometimes we listen to interpretations of very important ahadith, but unfortunately they're more, forgive the expression, but animalistic interpretations than true Islamic Irfani interpretations. But tonight I want to go through a few general points, and then tomorrow and the after we'll get deeper and deeper into the main subject, inshallah. There's no doubt that women have been oppressed throughout many societies since the beginning of time too. In Muslim societies and in non-Muslim societies. Sometimes in Muslim societies they've been oppressed more than in non-Muslim societies. There's no need to deny that. I mean, sometimes the woman is less respected in Muslim societies, sometimes they're more respected. It depends on different dimensions to the issue. In general though, in Muslim societies today, and even before, many things may arise and occur in them which aren't as positive as we would like them to be. One of them is the issue of women. Now that doesn't mean, and it doesn't justify us to say that we go, there's a very common sentence which one of the grand scholars of 100 years ago said, but that's been a bit abused these days. It's better not to utter these kind of sentences where people say, I go to the West, there are no Muslims, but I see Islam. And when I go to the East, I see Islam, I see Muslims, but no Islam. That's not a very accurate picture. Don't confine Islam to hygienic protocols or standing in queues. Islam is much deeper than this kind of thing. To be more accurate, you can say this would be unproblematic. I went to the West, there were no Muslims, but I saw more rational behavior in certain fields. And when I went to the East, there were Muslims, but I saw less rational behavior in certain fields. But Islam is something else. But that was just a marginal point. Now, the woman hasn't been granted the freedom to grow maximally in accordance with her true potential until recently, and in some societies. Maybe in America, she has more freedom, be it the Muslim or the non-Muslim woman, to attain to her true potential. It's possible, there's an argument for it, than in many non-Muslim countries. But even though some Western societies, do provide a good and positive opportunity for women to grow. For example, job-wise, different in different spheres, education-wise, and so on and so forth. There's still, in these societies, where the materialistic opportunities are there, or even non-materialistic, for example, educational, academic opportunities, there still exists, in these very societies, a serious concern with respect to how and what their take on women is. This problem still exists. Just because they're supposedly granted many freedoms, it doesn't mean they've solved the issue in relation to women. Usually the animalistic and non-spiritual dimensions of the woman are portrayed in such societies. Usually women are classified as objects of exploitation. That's not to say they're all exploited, but the way that they are conveyed, sometimes it's very harmful. This objectification, this sectionizing the status of the woman alone, this can do a lot of harm. And then in addition to this, it's the concept of the phenomenon of celebrification, where they choose two or three women and then everyone has to be like them in more ways than one. And then the beauty industry comes in, mass media comes in, everyone has to look like them. Suddenly we see in the last one or two decades all these different operations, liposuction, lipectomy, all these different things are multi-billion dollar businesses now. That's not to say to have a lipectomy or liposuction or injecting oneself with Botox or having a nose operation is bad. I'm not saying that. Sometimes someone truly feels that they need this for whatever reason, be it psychological, for the husband or whatever. I'm not justifying, I'm not saying it's good or bad, but there are instances where it is justified. But what is happening more often though is that we see that from the years of childhood the woman is forced to think that they have to have this operation. This body part has to be bigger or smaller. They're not thinking independently, they're just going with the flow, as is assigned by the media. They're telling you how to be, how to think. And that can be negative. Otherwise, there may be instances where these things can be justified. But you have to want it independently. It shouldn't be forced down your throat. And men too. This culture of celebrification affects men too. They also develop and acquire negative expectations of women. They also think that the woman has to be on a par with those two or three. This body part has to be big. If it's small, it's like that. If it's big, like that. They're also falling into the same trap. And all this is taking your true independent rationality from you. Day by day becoming more and more animalistic. That's problematic. But there are instances maybe the woman has a certain operation. It doesn't mean she's non-religious. She may have her own, as long as she thinks about it and comes to it independently, not because people expect it from her. Now, what's happening though, they're becoming brainwashed from childhood years. And this leads to a severe lack of irfan by people who are in those positions of authority, the beauty industry, media, and whatever society. The lesser the religiosity, spirituality of these people in these positions are, the more this objectification, celebrification, all this will become more and more. And we even see it in Muslim societies. It's not only in the non-Muslim societies. A lack of true religion will lead to such perceptions by people, women and men. Instead of teaching women what they are, those inner realities within her, what the goal in life is, they try to answer to these destiny-shaping questions in a very animalistic way. And that's a pity. The cheaper, the weaker, the lowlier the responses to these destiny-shaping questions become, the more debased the status of women becomes in any society. Now, then Islam enters the equation as a revelation, as a pure ideology, with a vast and diverse wealth of literature, of holy texts. And Islam provides answers to these questions. And in the next few lectures, inshallah, I'll be tackling the issue from the insight of primarily the Urafa, the Gnostics. Gnostics who have extrapolated their facts and their figures from the traditions, from the Ahlul Bayt, from the Holy Prophet, from the verses of the Holy Quran. They're not speaking outside the realm of Islam. Whatever there is, it's in the traditions, it's in the verses of the Holy Quran. And we see, inshallah, you will see, inshallah, that the way they have interpreted the woman is in such a manner that without awareness of these important aspects, even the insight of the common lay Muslim will fall short, will be dry, unproductive in relation to women. These are very important ethical instructions we're given. Highlight and they emphasize different traditions in particular ways without knowing these important and delicate matters, your understanding of women will fall short. This is for men and women. And this is a great pity. Confining discussions of women to fiqhi matters won't solve the problem. Canonical matters, fiqhi matters, ahkam, in relation to women is necessary. There's no denying that. But to think that it will solve all problems, it's a mistake. There's much more. There's more esoteric dimensions involved. Esoteric taqwini, providential matters upon which the fiqhi matters are extrapolated from. We have to go a bit deeper into this. Understanding the esoteric dimensions of the woman will then solve those issues in fiqh even, which seem problematic at face value. Why do you have so many questions everywhere you go when you speak about women? The same questions arise. It's either the nafaqa or in relation to inheritance, the diyah, and so on and so forth. And it's always unsolved. One of the reasons why it remains unsolved and people still don't receive is because they don't have any appreciation of the esoteric dimensions. Islam is wide religion with many dimensions, multidimensional. You can't just stick to one dimension and discard the others. It won't be a whole picture. Just because you know what women's rights are in Islam, it won't help you to appreciate, or it won't inform you as to the realities that reside within the creation of women. Why she was created, how she should be looked upon and treated, what her ultimate contribution to society, and a number of other essential questions. It won't help you in these areas. Okay, you know you have a list, you know all the women's rights. So what? You have to see why those rights came, from where they came, from what source they emanated from. And finally, there are even more deeper Irfani issues in relation to women. Things which I can't even touch upon, because I'm, at the end of the day, I'm male. It requires women to study in Qom or wherever for 10, 20 years, study a wide selection of important literature, and then for them to come back and they may be able to touch upon it more. Otherwise, if I want to speak about the esoteric dimensions of sacrifice in relation to women, I may not be able to do justice. So I won't touch on those very delicate things, but inshallah I'll touch upon a few ethical and Irfani aspects to it. The first point I want to mention, as I say, today's lecture, I want to cover a few general points before we enter the particular aspects of the debate. The Quran never addresses the man as the biological being. It's not man qua biological being which is addressed in the Quran. It's not woman qua biological being. The fact that they're biological beings isn't the reason why they're addressed. It addresses humankind, humans, mankind, ya ayyuhan nas, ya ayyuhal insan. It's irrelevant whether you are a male biological being or a female biological being. It addresses that which constitutes your essence, irrespective of whether you're male or female, and that's your spirit. In the most important messages the Quran relays to people, it's always addressing the spirit. It's not addressing the man with this biology or the woman with that biology. It's irrespective of that. It's addressing the spirit, whether you're a man or a woman. And there are a number of verses which I want to go through which highlight this. In chapter 95, verse 4, لَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ فِي أَحْسَنِ تَقْوِيمٍ. We certainly created humans in the best of forms. ثُمَّ رَدَدْنَاهُ أَسْفَلَ سَافِلِينَ. We relegated him to the lowest of the low. Now, you can be the best of the best, you can be the lowest of the low. Now, this can't be referring to the biological person here. Something much more deeper. This is referring to the spiritual you. It's nothing to do with what your physical phenotype is. Spiritually, you can be the best of the best, acquire proximity with Allah, or you can be the lowest of the low. To interpret this verse physically is doing a vast injustice. But we created humans. You see humans here, man or woman. You can be the best of the best, or you can be the lowest of the low. Now, true, it uses the male pronoun. For example, say we relegated him to the lowest of the low. But it doesn't mean the male biological being, though. This him, we have it in English too. For example, in English we say, man is a lofty creature, He has had a history since, let's say, this many thousand years ago. This he is not to say that that man doesn't include the woman. It's a way of speech. All languages have it. For example, in relation to earth or nature, we say she has experienced this many earthquakes. The use of pronouns here, we can't take too much into that, especially in the Arabian Peninsula 1400 years ago. If they kept on using female pronouns here, it could have been even problematic with the environment which was dominating at that time. Anyway, you have been created in the best way, and you have the best potential, each and every one of you, be you male or female. Chapter 17, verse 70. Certainly we have honored the children of Adam, and carried them over land and sea, and provided them with all the good things. And this is, وَفَضَّلْنَاهُمْ عَلَىٰ كَثِيرٍ مِمَّنْ خَلَقْنَا تَفْضِيلًا. And we've given them this advantage over many of those that we've created with a complete advantage. The children of Adam are honored and are honorable, whether you're male or female again. And this honor is secondary to none. Creation-wise, no one is superior to the other, male and female. O humans, chapter 4, verse 1, be wary of your Lord who created you from a single substance and created its mate from it, and from the two of them scattered numerous men and women. So even creation-wise, neither is superior to the other. These are general verses of the Qur'an, but they're very important when we come to future discussions, inshallah. To understand the logic of the Qur'an, these verses will help a lot. So even creation-wise, physique-wise, physically, there's no advantage one over the other. There's no marker or criterion for being more honorable, as we said, save one, and that's purely spiritual. Whoever has more taqwa is regarded more honorable. Inna akramakum indallah atqakum. Chapter 49, verse 13 says, O humans, indeed we created you from a male and female, made you nations and tribes that you may identify yourselves with one another. Indeed, the most honored, most dignified amongst you before Allah is the one with more taqwa. Also, one's access to acquiring Allah's mercy is equal and is secondary to your merit in this world. Be you man or a woman, your access to Allah's mercy is one. Now it depends how much you ask for it, how much you request for it. Chapter 9, 71, concerning the faithful men and faithful women, they enjoy the virtue, forbid the vice, maintain the salat, donate the zakat, and obey Allah and His Messenger. It is they, be you men or women again, to whom Allah will soon grant His mercy. The next point, and this is a bit delicate. I'll elaborate on this, inshallah, tomorrow or the day after. I'll just touch upon it now. Chapter 53, verse 39, nothing is man's save that which he strives for. لَيْسَ لِلْإِنسَانِ إِلَّا مَا سَعَى. You reap what you sow, be you man or woman. This world is the physical realm of existence. All other realms, in Barzakh, in Qiyamah, they're metaphysical. You reap what you sow in this world. Now, I've discussed this many times before, and I won't go into it too much now, that all those metaphysical realms of existence, it's a case of your actions being embodied, تجسم الأعمال. There's no matter anymore. There's no physical matter. There may be a mythology body, but there's nothing physical. Now the important thing here now is this. So be you man or woman, depending on how you acted, what you sowed in this world, you're creating your barzakh, you're creating your qiyamah, moment to moment, day to day in this world. Some people even see their barzakh and qiyamah, like the imams did, in this world. The important point here is this, that sex, male or female, is a function of one's anatomy, is a function of one's body parts. If you're female, you have X set of body parts, male has a certain set, and all these are physical. All these are physical criteria. So what would this mean in relation to the hereafter? Well, in addition to the fact that one's sex is secondary to one's essence, it also is alluding to the fact that there is no sex in the hereafter. Being a man or a woman has no meaning. Or we can say has a different meaning, but it's not as we conceive in this world. And that's an important point which I'll touch upon later. Chapter 74, verse 38, كُلُّ نَفْسٍ بِمَا كَسَبَتْ رَهِينَةٌ. Every soul is hostage to what it has earned, whether it's male or female. And finally, in chapter 16, 97, this is explicitly specifying that the road to spiritual perfection is open to all, equally. مَنْ عَمِلَ صَالِحَا, whoever executes the righteous action, مِنْ ذَكَرٍ أَوْ أُنْثَى, be you male or female, وَهُوَ مُؤْمِنٌ, whilst being a believer. Now, belief has many stages to it. Now, true, it says وَهُوَ مُؤْمِنٌ. This هُوَ is referring to the word man, whoever. Whoever executes a righteous action, وَهُوَ مُؤْمِنٌ, and he's a believer. Not he, in, you know, as if it's only referring to women. The verse is saying مِنْ ذَكَرٍ أَوْ أُنْثَى. Don't take too much into the male pronouns here. If you're male or female, if you execute righteous actions and have belief, and righteousness and belief has stages to it, فَلَنُحْيَنَّهُ حَيَاةً طَيِّبَةً, you will be revived with the prosperous life in this world and the hereafter. And حَيَاةً طَيِّبَةً is the stage of the مُخْلَصِين, the highest stage in spirituality, open to everyone. Otherwise you're all alive now, but you want to be revived with a special kind of life. So according to the Urafa, the definition of man is a divine living being with a very, very strong fitra in search of Allah. The potential is there for everyone. Now, whether that potential becomes actualized or not, that potential divinity within us all, that depends on 1,001 different parameters. But it's nothing to do with you being a man or a woman. If you're a man or a woman, the road to this perfection is there for everyone equally. Now, for some it's realized, this perfection. For most, this pure fitrat is buried by their sins. In relation to the latter, those who are buried in their sins, those who have veiled their fitra, that source of their potential divinity, the logic of the verses describes such people as not being alive. Now they're all living physically, but they're not alive in the true sense. Chapter 36, verse 70, in relation to the philosophy behind revelation, Allah says, so that anyone who is alive be warned, and that the word may come due against the faithless. Those who are truly alive, on hearing revelation, they do become warned. The fitra is alive, they're not dead spiritually. But here, being alive is used horizontally to those who are faithless. So it's not referring to being physically alive. It's being alive with the heart of faith. The faithless too, they're living, but they're not alive in the spiritual sense. Also in chapter 35, verse 22, it states, Allah makes those who want to hear, to hear. And you cannot make those who are in their graves hear. I don't want to go through this verse again, but إِنَّ اللَّهَ يَهْدِي مَا يَشَاءُ وَيَضِلُّ مَا يَشَاءُ. Those who have been in my previous lectures, it's in relation to this. Those who want to hear, hear. It's all to do with you. Your salvation, your destiny is in your hands. If you just make that effort to want to hear, Allah will make you hear. And you cannot make those who are in their graves sin. Because the faithless, and this is not the graves when after we die, here the faithless, they're imprisoned and buried in their own animal selves. They've barred themselves from their true essence, what they should be. The fitra is veiled. So those who are buried in their graves here, in this sense, in their animal selves, you can't make them hear. They've blocked their hearing. Now, in all these verses I've mentioned so far, first of all, it's clear that it's addressing both men and women. It never addresses men alone. Never addresses women alone. Sometimes when it gives examples of particular men, good or bad, or particular women, good or bad, it just wants to give examples. Not that it's only for women or men. But in all these verses, the attributes employed in praise of women and in praise of men is predicated to that which they both share, and that's the Spirit. These attributes are predicated onto the Spirit, nothing to do with the physical part. For example, in chapter 33, verses 35 and 36, I'll just quickly go through it. Indeed, the Muslim men and the Muslim women, the faithful men and the faithful women, the obedient men, the obedient women, patient men, patient women, the humble men, the humble, and so on and so forth. This obediency, being humble, being patient, has nothing to do with the physical side. It's directed towards the spirit of the man and the woman. When it calls you patient, it calls you obedient, humble. Those who guard their private parts, those who, men and women, men who remember Allah greatly, and the women who remember, all these different attributes in praise of both men and women, it's directed to the spirit. Nothing to do with the material side. The material side is just a means to act. In this world, the spirit is dependent on the body, action-wise. That's it. But the I, the essence of what we are, is not the spirit, it's not the body, the physical body. That's secondary to who we are. So, now in this world, half of us have been given the female body, half of us... Thank you very much. Half of us have been granted the male body. The truth and reality of what we are is the spirit. And the spirit is sexless. Some spirits, and we're equal spirit-wise, our potential and so on and so forth. Some spirits have been granted a female body. Some spirits have been, and they're called women in this world. Some spirits have been granted a male body, and they are men in this world. Now, the provider of this equipment, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for men, those body parts, for women, female body parts, He's granted us all a set of protocol of instructions, enabling us with that equipment which He's granted us to acquire proximity to Him. Because now we've been assigned different set of equipment and body parts. Here, very little protocol-wise, in the domain of the rulings and ahkam, it differs a bit, but the potential to acquire proximity is equal. Just because they're different phenotypically, it doesn't mean that one is more accessible to Allah than the other. Be you man or woman, you both can acquire the highest states of Iman. You can't say that men are able to acquire more faith than women. The fact that the Holy Prophets were all men has nothing to do with faith. That there are other matters involved in why men were prophets, not because they had more faith. And that will come maybe, inshallah, later. Now, the body is to remain with us forever. In all realms of existences, we'll have a body. In this world, it's a physical body. In other realms of existence, there's no physical body, but we have a body. And it's interesting that, well, according to the Gnostics like Mullah Sadra and others, it's this physical body per se which grows into the non-physical mythali body in the other realms of existences. There's no difference. It's still one reality. As a result of what he calls substantial motion of the physical body, in other realms of existences, it's the same body, but another manifestation of it. It's not different. It's just that the body is the body. Here, it's the physical body. That's what we see. In Barzakh, it's the mythali body. In Qiyamah, it depends on your take. If some people say it's the physical body returns, some people say it's the mythali body continues. But the body will always be with you. But here is the physical body. And with physical bodies comes this classification of sex, male and female. This classification doesn't exist in other realms of existences. Okay, that was one point. Just trying to highlight the language of revelation. Another interesting point, which the Quran does highlight in different parts, is when it comes to life, there's a principle termed the law of pairs. That's the P-A-I-R-S. And this is addressed in verses, chapter 36, verse 36, chapter 51, verse 49. In all things we created pairs so that you may take admonition. In another verse, immaculate is he who created pairs, all of them, from that which the earth grows, from themselves people, and from which they do not know. Everything exists in pairs. Now, pairs doesn't necessarily have to mean male and female. It does in most instances. But there are other interpretations of what pairs here. But I want just to focus on this male-female set of pairs. Here, with this law of pairs, it's as if this reality of pairing is essential to the survival of different forms of existence, animals, humans, plants, whatever. And it can be a materialistic survival or spiritual, but pairing is essential. Now, A people and animal example of this pairing is seen in chapter 11, verse 40, when Prophet Noah, alayhi salam, is instructed to, I quote, carry in it a pair of every kind. That was in the ark. Okay, that was the external side of the story. The main point there was survival. Survival, be it materialistic or spiritual, survival requires pairing. Now, this can be to, it can be in relation to the survival of terrestrial animals, as well as those 80 people who were there in the ark. With humans, though, this pairing, although our essence is uniform, the immaterial rational spirit, in this world, we've all been assigned a certain phenotype, some male, some female, for this pairing to occur, for that potential to be acquired, for our elevation to be even higher. We've been assigned different phenotypes so that this pairing is realized. Without the pairing too, it's possible. I don't want to. Well, the spiritual perfection may be possible. The road to spirituality is still open. Although, survival-wise, on a materialistic level, it wouldn't have been able to survive without male and females. However, even spiritually, pairing enables one to reach to higher realms than if there were no pairing. So, sex is secondary to who or what we are by essence. And this divine pairing has two objectives behind it. Firstly, it guarantees the survival of the human species, but more importantly, it's one of the many tools required in man's spiritual wayfaring, pairing. And that's why a successful marriage is one's ticket to Allah. It involves this pairing once again. And that we'll speak about, inshallah, tomorrow. So, each spirit has to elevate whilst living in this world. Now, either through the physical male or the physical female body, in addition to living in the world, the physical cosmos in general. Whatever it is, is a means of your spiritual elevation. In chapter 2, 115. Wherever you look, the face of Allah is there. أَيْنَمَا تُوَلُّوا فَثَمَّ وَجْهُ اللَّهِ. Whatever is, but that's the goal, that's the end goal, where you reach such a stage. Yeah. Whatever it is, is a means of your spiritual elevation. In chapter 2, 115. Wherever you look, the face of Allah is there. أَيْنَمَا تُوَلُّوا فَثَمَّ وَجْهُ اللَّهِ. Whatever is, but that's the goal, that's the end goal, where you reach such a stage. We have to undergo many preliminary stages before that. In the same way, the village, town, country where you were raised, the school, or whatever, things that influence your bringing, the way you were brought up, in the same way, all these different parameters has an effect and an influence on your character, good or bad, depending on how you react to that environment. In the same way, one's body shares the same ruling. Now, what do I mean by that? Now, if you were born, let's say, in America, Africa, wherever, that doesn't justify you being good or bad per se. It depends how you react to that environment. Body-wise, we all have a different, we all have different degrees of hormones, cerebral synaptic transmitters, and 101 different bodily things, which influences our character too. But there's no excuse to be good or bad because of those. It pushes you. Some people are more prone to be angry. Some people are more prone to be patient. Some people may be more prone to things like homosexuality. It's possible. If you hear of the homosexual gene, they'd be threatened by it. The potential is there. What precipitates it is the environment, how you reacted to it. Even for bodily diseases like cancer and many other things, these are all genetic. The potential is there within everyone. But it wants smoking, for example, to precipitate the oncogene, and so on and so forth. It depends how you react to the environment. So all these different bodily parameters can exert influences upon the individual, but ultimately it's up to the spirit to decide one's fate. There's no excuse. You can't say, oh, because my hormones was like that, or my this was like that. These are no excuse whatsoever. According to the logic of the Quran, it's no excuse. The route to spiritual perfection is one and equal to everyone. Don't bring your male or female bodily manifestations as an excuse. So, in short then, whenever there's talk of values or anti-values, it's never conditional upon one's sex. It's always directed to the sexless spirit. And the subject matter in spiritual wayfaring is the spirit, and man and woman has the potential to acquire Allah's attributes. The route to perfection is open to all. Now you can slowly start the debate. At least we'll start today a bit. What strikes the eye, though, after saying all this? It's incredible that women, the route to perfection for them seems to start many years earlier than for men. In relation to this journey to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in relation to acquiring proximity to Allah, doing the salat which ascends one to Allah, as-salatu mi'rajul mu'min, doing the fasting which makes one more and more Allah-like, doing the wajib salat, doing the wajib hajj, has been offered to women many years before it becomes offered to men. And this shows that they have something extra, potential-wise even, that men don't. And this is something incredible, that why they should be given this. Now, as to the why, it will be evident, inshallah, in future sessions. I just want to raise these as questions for now. But all these arise at an age during which the male counterpart doesn't acquire this merit at that time. So there is this mi'raji or angelic potential which exists in them before it arises in men. And it's in this light that we have to interpret some traditions. There's one prophetic tradition which states that I have been made to like three things from your world: women, perfume, and salat is the comfort of my eyes. Now this is one of those very important traditions, and I'll speak more about this tomorrow, but just one memory I have of, I was once invited somewhere. There were three scholars there, and two, I think, engineers or doctor, I can't remember exactly, but the scholars were invited at this house, and there were only five men, and the woman was in the kitchen, and we were in the room which was adjacent to the kitchen. And then this tradition came up. The reason it came up because one of the scholars was saying, and they were very strong scholars, they were definitely more senior to me in age and in knowledge. Well, one of them in age, not the other. He said, yes, look, women is one of the things which the Holy Prophet likes. and being active with women in the biological sense, being active a lot is something recommended, it's very important. And this is incredible how even a scholar who's been in a hose in the East for so many, such a long time, that's the understanding he got from this tradition. It was a very, very animalistic understanding of this very important tradition. That yes, it's good to be, and now the wife of the woman is in the kitchen. And actually the husband was also saying, yes, you're right actually, yes. And it was very embarrassing for me. I mean, I didn't say anything, but it was very, very embarrassing. You see, this is where deep understanding of the traditions and not sufficing with the prima facie face value meaning, this is where it's important. You may all have heard this tradition. Three things are mentioned here: women, perfume, and salat. Why should women be used and be mentioned horizontally to salat here? Salat is something celestial. It makes no sense for the Holy Prophet to mention something very, very celestial, and then when it mentions women, you take the very, very animalistic side. The women and perfume have deeper esoteric meanings here, which is on a par with salat. It's the celestial dimension of the women here, the celestial dimension, the heavenly dimension of perfume. The mentioning of salat here in this tradition is a code for you to understand the women and perfume more. But it's this heavenly dimension which has to be opened up a bit. Even if you want to be adamant and stick to that biological sense, even those have esoteric dimensions, which if you see fit, I can mention maybe. Well, it depends on the ages of people too, but everything, many actions, all actions, from the kitchen to the workplace to the bed, has esoteric dimensions. But we suffice with the animalistic. And it's a pity. And it's these dimensions I want to open up, inshallah, in the next few days. For example, in relation to perfume too, what it means, how different perfumes would remind the Holy Prophet of his mi'rajis, how it would remind him of different things, including Imams Hassan and Hussein, alayhimus salam, and so on and so forth. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. But loving women out of instinct or the biological impulse alone, that's not meant. And if it is meant, it's only one very small dimension of it. To confine it to that interpretation is just a pity. Otherwise, how can this be compatible with Islam's divine, lofty objectives? Women is used on a par with salat here. Anyway, during the next few days, I'll mention many traditions, inshallah, and the esoteric dimensions. For example, another one is where the Holy Prophet said, loving women is one of the Prophet's traits. All Prophets had this. But it wasn't the materialistic, animalistic type. Something much more deeper. It was the love of women qua heavenly entities. And this dimension of it, inshallah, I'll open up soon. But this is a good index to judge oneself. Men or women, both of you, if you want to judge yourself, see how your love to women is. How do you look at women? How do you look at your mothers? Or women in general? But for the women, it's more how they look at their mothers, their family. For example, they say wives are a comfort to you. Again here, what does comfort mean? They're a source of your comfort. Again, we see interpretations where it limits it to cooking, cleaning, whereas no, something much more deeper. It's a divine comfort here. What does divine comfort mean? How? Heaven lies under their feet. What does this mean? We have traditions where if you're doing nafile salat and your mother calls upon you, you can break your salat. The fuqaha have accepted this. But if your father calls you, no. Yeah? Okay? These are inner esoteric dimensions here. Why can you break the salat for your mother? Three things are loved: women, perfume, salat. We have traditions that you can execute you can execute favoritism in relation to your wife over your children. In relation to your children, you can't execute any favoritism. But in relation to your wife, you can. And many other traditions. Or most virtues, most good exists in women. I mean, I'm just uttering these just in title-wise. I mean, I'll recite the Arabic and the translation and the interpretation, inshallah, as we progress. Now, why should most good exist in women? You're going to have a very hard time to prove this if you want to limit yourself to the animalistic realm. But the Urafa have given us some explanations. Now, so all these good that we see, and we will see, inshallah, even if we do encounter, even if we do encounter authentic traditions which say, don't consult with your wives, don't consult with women, or women are intellectually deficient. All these, first of all, the wording is the wording of the transmitter. Doesn't mean that the Imam used the same words. Ibn Ashub, a very prominent scholar of the last century, said most of the problems that arise is by the wording of the transmitters. They've caused most of the problem. They got the meaning, but when they wanted to word it, they sometimes, well, according to some scholars, most times, they failed in relation to being able to convey that meaning. But let's say, even if they were authentic and the wording was the same, according to what we've read so far, in relation to the logic of the verses of the Quran, it's impossible to extrapolate that this applies to all women. And when you look at the occasion of the tradition when it was revealed, or when it was said, it was in relation to particular women who did particular actions. If men do those actions, those same actions, they too will be intellectually deficient. Those too, according to one tradition, Imam Bukhari says, don't consult them either, the men. It's nothing to do with one's sex. Depends on your actions. So that's how you have to interpret these kind of traditions. Otherwise, according to the logic of the Holy Quran and the traditions, the road to spirituality, the road to perfection is equal to men and women, and the road to deficiency and relegation, ثُمَّ رَدَدْنَاهُ أَسْفَلَ صَافِلِينَ, is open to men and women. Depends how you want to act. And this has a lot of connotations when it comes in the realm of fiqh. Otherwise, traditions have to be interpreted in the light of other traditions. We have one tradition which says, call out and clap. Now what call out and clap means is, if a man or woman enters the salat in the middle of it and wants the imam to wait or extend it a bit so they can join the salat, to ask the woman to clap, the men to call out, like Inna Allaha Ma'a As-Sabirin, for example. But if you just say call out and clap and take it at face value, any kind of interpretation, traditions have to be interpreted by verses of the Quran and other traditions. You can't just find one tradition and say, this is this meaning, so all women become intellectually deficient. No. Now, okay, I know there's a very shortage of scholars in Los Angeles, and all of you are very, you really like to go and read traditions, but you have to be careful not to, when you read the traditions, I don't want to bore you from reading it, because that love for tradition, you want to learn. But don't make your own conclusions when you read certain traditions. Do you ask the local scholar or ask someone at least, email, and so on and so forth. At least don't fall into making your own conclusion. That's all I ask. Because sometimes, after many years of, you know, jumping to your own conclusion, it becomes very difficult for you to come out of it. And that makes the works of, you know, professors or scholars even more difficult to try. Okay. I'll stop here and just read a few words of Musibat bereavement, and I'll end with your permission. 230 after Hijrah, and died 276. That means he was present during, if I'm correct, the birth of the 12th Imam was 255, correct me if I'm wrong or not, but so he was around, how old, 25 years at that time. For the major occultation, he was 30. So he, I'm not saying he actually saw the Imam or saw the deputies of the Imam, but he was there at that time. His awareness wasn't, you know, fully deficient like ours is. He was aware of what's happening during that time. He has a book called Tariq al-Khulafa. And I want to read as words of bereavement in relation to Fatima al-Zahra from him, and then I'll choose another source, which is a Shia source. But before I start the Arabic, and just to explain what's happened before we enter the actual text. So when Abu Bakr's Khalifa was announced, as you know, Amir al-Mu'mineen, alayhi salam, he wasn't present at Saqifah when they selected Abu Bakr as the first Khalifa. He was, according to Shia traditions, he was busy with burying the Holy Prophet. And he was finishing off his last touches to the grave. He had a spade in his hand and he was clearing up the edges of the grave. And then either Abu Dharr or Salman came in haste to Amir al-Mu'mineen, said, Sayyidi, Sayyidi, Master, Master, have you heard the news? Amir al-Mu'mineen replied in the negative. Then either Abu Dharr or Salman said that a companion, they weren't there either, but they said a companion who was there informed him that what has just happened in Saqifah, i.e. Abu Bakr had been elected. And then according to traditions in the Shia sources, they say that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam placed his hands on the spade's handle after spearing it into the ground, chin on the hands, and he exclaimed, Ajab, incredible, really, Ajab. Anyway, they started acquiring or collecting allegiances from the people to Abu Bakr. Abbas, the uncle of the Holy Prophet, his children, Salman, Abu Dharr, and a few others were in Ali's house. They didn't pay allegiance. And the children and the women of the household too, they were there. But they were in the process of collecting allegiances, and it's from here where we want to continue the story. So Ibn Qutaybah is relating this. It's a Sunni important source. The very beginning of Islam too, 238 is very early on. And I want to be faithful to the text, so I'll be reciting the actual text here. وَإِنَّ أَبَا بَكْرَ رَضِيَ اللَّهُ عَنْهُ تَفَقَّدَ قَوْمًا تَخَلَّفُوا عَنْ بَيْعَتِهِ عِنْدَ عَلِيٍّ كَرَّمَ اللَّهُ وَجْهَهُ. Abu Bakr رَضِيَ اللَّهُ عَنْهُ found a group of people who had gone against paying allegiance to him, and they were in Ali's house. After Ali, it's very common amongst the Sunni brothers, they say karramallahu wajha. I'm not 100% sure why they use this expression, but I've been told maybe it's because that even when he, during the period of gestation, he would always put his face towards the Holy Prophet. So when the Holy Prophet would move, although he was in the womb of Fatima bint Asad alayhi salam, and he would move with the Prophet, although he was in the womb. There may be others too, I'm not sure. So Abu Bakr had seen that there are people who are not paying allegiance. And so, and they were in Ali's house. فَبَعَثَ إِلَيْهِمْ Umar. So Abu Bakr sent Umar to these people. فَجَاءَ Umar went to Ali's house. فَنَادَاهُمْ وَهُمْ فِي دَارِ Ali. And Umar called out to them whilst they were in Ali's house. He called out to them. فَأَبَوْ أَيَّخْرَجُوا The people in Ali's house, Abbas, his children, Hassan, Hussein, Abu Dhar, Salman, and many others, they refrained from exiting the house. فَدَعَى بِالْحَتَبْ Umar then requested splinters of wood to be assembled. وَقَالَ Umar said, وَالَّذِي نَفْسُ Umar بِيَدِهِ By he in whose hands lies Umar's life, لَتُخْرِجَنَّ أَوْ لَأُحَرِّقَنَّهَا عَلَى مَنْ فِيهَا Either you will most certainly exit, or I will most certainly burn the house down with all those in it. This is a Sunni source here. فَقِيلَ لَهُ Then it was said to Umar by someone who was present there, Ya Abu Hafs, which was the title given to Umar, O father of Hafs, Inna fiha Fatima. But Fatima is in that house. He was threatening to burn it down. One of the companions said, But Fatima, out of everyone in that house, even Fatima is in there. Faqala Umar. Wa in. So what? Fakharaju. But they left the house, they exited the house. Maybe Amir al-Mu'mineen gave the instruction. For whatever reason, he told the male members there to leave. Fabayau. And they gave their, paid their allegiance. Illa Aliya. Except for Ali. Didn't leave yet. Then Ali said, "Halaftu an la akhruja wa la adha'a thawbi ala atiqi hatta ajma' al-Qur'an. I have sworn on my life by Allah, I shall neither exit nor place any clothing upon my shoulders." Because when you leave the house, you wear something. I shall neither exit nor wear anything until I assemble the Qur'an. He wanted to assemble the Qur'an with many extra things in a particular manner which wasn't assembled before. فَوَقَفَتْ فَاتِمَا رَضِيَ اللَّهُ عَنْهَا عَلَى بَابِهَا Fatima alayhi salam stopped at the door of the house, she being the defender of wilaya here. She had still remained with the other women. She didn't go. فَقَالَتْ Fatima said, according to Ibn Qutaybah, لَا أَحْدَ لِي بِقَوْمٍ هَذَرُوا أَسْوَأُ مَحْذَرٍ مِنْكُمْ I've never witnessed a people's presence worse than yours. تَرَكْتُمْ رَسُولَ اللَّهِ جَنَازَةً بَيْنَ أَيْدِينَا You abandoned the body, the corpse of the Holy Prophet to us. وَقَتَعْتُمْ أَمْرَكُمْ بَيْنَكُمْ And you've made the matter definitive amongst yourselves. The matter of leadership here is because this was after Saghifah. لَمْ تَسْتَأْمُرُونَ She said, you never consulted us with this matter. وَلَمْ تَرَدُّ لَنَا حَقًّا. You never returned us our due right. That which was our right, you never returned it to us. After she said this, فَأَتَى عُمَرْ أَبَا بَكْرِ. Umar went to Abu Bakr. فَقَالَ لَهُ. He said to Abu Bakr, أَلَا تَأْخُذُ هَذَا الْمُتَخَلِّفَ عَنْكَ بِالْبَيْعَ. Aren't you going to seize him who is going against paying allegiance to you? فَذَهَبَ إِلَىٰ عَلِي. No, sorry. فَقَالَ أَبُو بَكْر. After Umar said this to Abu Bakr, he said, aren't you going to seize this man who is a mutakhallif, is going against you in paying allegiance? فَقَالَ أَبُو بَكْر لِقُنْفُذْ. Abu Bakr said to Qunfuz, وَهُوَ مَوْلَى لَهُ. Abu Bakr was the master of Qunfuz. اِذْهَبْ فَدْعُ لِي عَلِيَّا. Go and call Ali before me. فَذَهَبَ إِلَىٰ عَلِي. Qunfuz went to Ali, alayhi salam. Ali said to him, فَقَالَ لَهُ مَا حَاجَتُكْ. What's the matter, Qunfuz? What do you want? Qunfuz said, فَقَالَ يَدْعُوكَ خَلِيفَةُ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ. The Khalifa, the successor of the Messenger of Allah, is calling you. فَقَالَ عَلِي لَسَرِيعٌ مَا كَذِبْتُمْ عَلَى رَسُولِ اللَّهِ. How soon you have attributed falsehood to the Prophet of Allah, to the Messenger of Allah. On hearing this, Qunfuz returned. فَرَجَعَ فَأَبْلَغَ الرَّسَالَةِ. Qunfuz returned, and they exited Ali from the house and took him to Abu Bakr. I'll end here with the extract of Ibn Qutaybah. And we say to Ibn Qutaybah that out of his sincerity, and he was very truthful, and we respect these words of truthfulness that Ibn Qutaybah has highlighted for us. But with your permission, we say to Ibn Qutaybah that the truth, when you say أخرجوا أليان, they took Ali out, there were more realities to this situation. And here the Shia sources have gone into more detail. And here, with your permission, I'll recite from Tabarsi's إحتجاجات. He says, ثم نادى عمر بأعلى صوته حتى أسمع عليّا. The same scenario, and you'll see similar wording, but details are in more detail here. Umar, with his loudest voice, shouted so that Ali hears, Wallahi latakhrujanna wal tubayyanna khalifata rasulullah aw la'azramanna alayka baytaka nara. By Allah, I swear that you will exit the house and you will pay allegiance to the successor of the Messenger of Allah, or I will burn the house down with all of you in. ثم رجع. He then returned, Umar, فقعد عند أبي بكر. Sat down with Abu Bakr. وهو يخاف أن يخرج علي علي بسيفه. And he feared that Ali may exit the house with a sword in hand. لِمَا قَدْ عَرَفَ مِنْ بَأْسِهِ وَشِدَّتِهِ. After all, he knew how Ali would treat his enemies. ثُمَّ قَالَ. Umar said, لِلْقُنْفُزْ. He said to Qunfuz, إِنْ خَرَجْ وَإِلَّا فَقْتَهِمْ عَلَيِّ الدَّارِ فَإِنْ اِمْتَنْهَا فَأَزْرِمْ عَلَيْهِمْ بَيْتَهُمُ النَّارِ. If Ali leaves, Qunfuz, if Ali leaves, so be it. But if he doesn't leave, you charge in without permission. And if he still refuses, burn down the whole thing. فانطلق قنفذ. قنفذ set off. فاقتحم الدار and he charged in. هو وأصحابه به بغير إذن. He and his companions, they charged in the house without any permission. فبادر علي إلى سيفه ليأخذه. And he went for his sword to take his sword. فسبقوه إلي. But they got to the sword before Ali. فكثروا علي. And they surrounded Ali in his house. فقبضوه. They seized upon him. وألقوا في عنقه حبلا أسود. Yes, they did exit Ali out, but they put a rope around his neck, a black rope. وحالت فاطمة بين زوجها وبينه in the Bab al-Bayt. The defender of Wilaya, Fatima alayhi salam, came between her husband and the people there at the door of the house. فضربها قنفذ بالصوت. ألا إلى قنفذ اضربها اضربها. قنفذ started whipping her. Out of the order of whipping was given to him. فألجاها إلى إزادة باب بيتها. These actions made Fatima عليه السلام take refuge to the horizontal planks, wooden planks of the house, because at that time the doors constituted a number of vertical planks of wood and two horizontal ones. It made her take refuge to the planks of wood there. فَدَفَأَهَا. He pushed her around by pushing the door. فَكَسَرَ ذِلْعًا مِنْ جَنْبِهَا. A rib was broken. وَأَلْغَتْ جَنِينًا مِنْ بَطْنِهَا. Her fetus was aborted. فلم تزل صاحبة فلاش حتى ماتت من ذلك شهيدا. And since then Fatima was always under care until she died as a shaheed. وصلى الله على محمد وآل طيب.